Welcome to Tech San Diego Spotlight Podcast. I'm Kevin Carroll, Executive Director of Tech San Diego, coming to you from our beautiful offices in sunny San Diego. You know it as technology's perfect climate. Looking forward to today's program. Things are so fluid in immigration, and Tech San Diego is very fortunate. We have one of the, I was going to say the regions, but I'm going to backtrack on that. I'm going to say one of the global experts on current immigration trends and what's going on. Corinne Wenger from Fragoment. Corinne, welcome to the podcast again.
Thank you, Kevin. It's a pleasure to be back. Thanks for having me.
It seems like we just had you on, but things are so fluid, and not just from an immigration regulatory structure, but also from how companies are structuring their immigration, how they're thinking about it. And so while I'm sure we're going to talk to you a little bit about the changes in regulatory, you and I were talking offline about how companies are kind of adapting and changing. So I'm interested to get to that. I don't know how you guys are coping during this, because it seems like everyone has immigration questions. I'm going to assume you and your shop at Fragoment are extremely busy now.
We're extremely busy. Certainly, we're in the middle of the H-1B cap season, but immigration issues are popping up as we all face this great talent shortage or great resignation, I think that it's called. And obviously, everybody's feeling it, and perhaps employers who rely on foreign talent even more so.
By the way, Corinne and I had spoke very early during the Ukraine crisis about possible opportunities to, at least temporarily, there's a burgeoning IT sector in Ukraine. There still is. And is there anything we can do? And we came to the conclusion, we contacted a congressional office that, moving that mountain would be more than moving a mountain, but we'd be moving several mountains. But is there anything that the Ukraine crisis, do we see any changes in immigration policy, especially as referring to maybe Ukrainian refugees?
Yeah, that's a great question, and certainly many of us have mobilized, in the private sector, in the legal industry, to provide pro bono services to the Ukrainian community. The administration did extend temporary protected status to Ukrainians, which is well welcomed, of course. It is a bit limited for folks who had been in the U.S. at a particular period of time. But if anyone in the community is aware of Ukrainian nationals physically in the U.S. at the moment, they can certainly reach out and we can assess whether or not they qualify. But the large national efforts happening right now. We're actually partnering with an organization, a nonprofit called Lawyers for Good Government. Believe it's headed up by Kirkland Ellis, actually. And so there's a lot going on, a lot of ways for folks to help there. But we're still limited with the immigration rules that we have aside from this temporary protected status.
Well, and you really learn how entrenched of a bureaucracy immigration is. When I started asking these questions, I was a little naive when I started asking this. I've told, a lot of our legislators that the best way we could damage Russia would be to take all their top talent away, and we should find a way to do that quickly and easily. And I hope bigger brains than mine are working on that. But let's get back to what companies the key word to me is really how companies are adapting, right? They're coming out of COVID. They had stranded people and everything else. And so when you're working with companies, and this is probably less a regulatory schedule than just how companies are adapting and how they're doing it, how are companies kind of rethinking their immigration benefits, I guess you would call that you've been seeing?
Right. Yeah. I mean, the pandemic obviously was certainly a tumultuous time for employers, their employees. And out of that came out kind of a renewed vision, if you will, on kind of the immigration benefits that they provide. During the pandemic, it became clear that the impact was not only to their employees, but to their dependents. Some of them had gone home for Lunar New Year, right? And all of a sudden were stuck abroad because of the travel bans. Extended even beyond that, right, to the extended family members. Parents came to visit on a visitor visa and were stuck because in the U.S. and potentially facing an overstay of status because they weren't able to travel. So employers were called upon to support the employees a bit more broadly. And that kind of stayed, honestly, post-pandemic, if we can call it that at the moment. You know, the next challenge, of course, is this shift in the work environment, the workplace that we're all kind of navigating through right now. But the hybrid work model does present some compliance considerations that that impact immigration. And also looking at immigration, a company's immigration policy. It's really kept that conversation alive, and they're revisiting their policy. Do we continue to support dependent spouses? How far do we go? And then you put that all in the backdrop of what's going on right now with talent wars and remaining competitive in attracting talent, retaining talent, and kind of leveraging that the immigration benefits to their advantage.
Yeah, I think you know, the higher in technical you go, I think the more seems to position companies in a more competitive nature, depending on how liberal their policies are. You mentioned a couple of them, you know, the support for spouses and families and things like that. Are the work authorizations for spouses, these are the H-4 and L-2, has anything been changing in those, or are companies sponsoring more of those, or?
Yeah, so you may recall there was a big shift with respect to work authorization for spouses a couple of years ago, allowing limited spouses in H-4 to be eligible for work authorization, and that obviously created a new talent pipeline all of a sudden, right? And so that's kind of kept going, and more employers are looking at extending, you know, that benefit to their employees and covering legal fees and expenses for that. There are other considerations, you know, are they covering premium processing across the board? During the pandemic, we certainly have seen an increase in government processing times, which has added to the anxiety that was already existing and created by the pandemic. Understanding whether or not a case was going to be approved, how long was it going to take? So, you know, those are some factors that employers are considering at the moment to cover. There's a lot, as we get into the discussion of kind of policy changes and regulatory changes, there's been significant changes with respect to the work authorization for dependent spouses. Last November, I believe, following a settlement agreement that came from a lawsuit that challenged lengthy processing delays on work permits, USCIS changed its policy and for the first time kind of provided an automatic extension for work permits for H-4 spouses, L-2s. And while that was, that at first glance, that seemed quite positive, the details in the policy are very important because of the timing. The automatic extension, and trying to keep this as high level as possible, the automatic extension applies so long as that their status doesn't expire earlier. So everybody that's in the United States that's admitted gets an admission record. It's on an I-94 card. It has a status and a validity period. That validity period, of course, is tied to the primary spouse's, you know, primary H-1B employee's status. If the H-4 dependent spouse's I-94 card expires, that automatic extension of the work permit, that can be filed, but it won't apply. So while we can extend, file an extension for the H-4, and that H-4 spouse is able to stay in the U.S. while it's pending beyond that I-94 card expiration, the same doesn't apply for the EAD, so the work authorization. So there are some limitations. There are strategic ways to kind of navigate these provisions and that could benefit the spouse, but it's not as black and white as it makes it seem.
And again, I think the reasons why, and I know it was an extended discussion, but because it's, you know, we talked about the talent wars and you know, and immigration is a stopgap measure for a lot of companies, right? And they've also, I think you're right, they've also seen that this hybrid work model opens up the gates a little bit to looking at immigration where maybe they didn't look at it before, right? And so it's interesting. So I'm going to assume that the U.S. government, in all of its infinite wisdom with our talent shortage, has opened up the H-1B visas and quadrupled the number they're going to have, with a preference on innovation economy degrees, and everything is humming along smoothly with H-1B visas, and we just need to send an email and they'll give us an exemption right away. Is that correct assumption?
Yeah, not quite. But I like where you're going with this, because you know, having been around for a while, you know, back in the .com era, right, the boom in the late 90s, right, early 2000, the cap was actually elevated, right? It was elevated to 115,000 for a couple of years, and then again there was provisions to elevate that to 195,000. I mean, gosh, imagine 195,000 H-1B numbers available would be just gold right now. Unfortunately, that's not the case. The cap reverted back in 2004 to the 65,000 plus an additional 20 for those who have U.S. advanced degrees. So we're stuck with the 85,000. And just to kind of put it in perspective, and I have this conversation frequently with employers to kind of explain the ratio and the demand, supply and demand situation that we're in. This year, we had nearly 484,000 registrations for this fiscal year 2023. That's a 57%
increase. Hold on. You said 484,000 for 85?
Correct. Correct.
Can you imagine the impact on the economy of every single one of those 484 were approved?
Right. Right. Exactly. Exactly. And it's a 57% increase from last year, right? So now I do want to pause and say, it doesn't mean that just because that many, you know, submitted a registration that all of these are eligible and will ultimately be approved, right? There's probably a certain percentage that are just going to fall off. But it's a clear indication, right, that the H-1B demand is not slowing down. And it provides challenges, right, for employers who have on payroll, have onboarded foreign student graduates, right, who have been on this what's called optional practical training, which comes after their graduation. And in STEM fields, luckily, they get a total of 3 years. But so you kind of have three bites at the apple on this H-1B cap. But with these kind of numbers, it's really becoming unpredictable. And employers are having to look at other avenues for sure.
Yeah, it's really a shame that the immigration debate gets really, it should be bifurcated into, you know, you could have an illegal immigration debate while you could also have a merit-based debate as well, and they could happen. You know, it seems like we'd be intelligent enough to have those at the same time, and we've really been unable to, right? The national conversation on illegal immigration prevents the secondary discussion from going on. You know, geez, how difficult would it be to take the graduates to have 3 years, and as long as they're in the United States and they're doing good things and staying, you know, not no criminal activity or anything, automatically turn those into some type of an H-1B. It's really a shame. So one of the issues I've been arguing that, you know, I've wanted to make H-1B more accessible to small and medium-sized businesses. At one time, the very large IT services firms would monopolize a big portion of those 85K. Do you think that process has gotten a little better, and the small mid-sized companies have a better shot at an H-1B visa than maybe they have had in the past?
You know, I think the challenge is the smaller kind of companies that perhaps are kind of coming to the game a little late, right? Might miss the registration. I've had certainly conversations with companies that come to me once the registration has closed, right? Or they think, oh, they're on... I've got a year on the optional practical training, or we've got 3 years because this individual is on a STEM degree. So they're not necessarily in tune with the reality of it's not open to everybody. Just because you apply doesn't mean that you get it. So I think that's the challenge primarily with the smaller companies, because at the end of the day, you know, it is a lottery system. And so, you know, you put in your name and it's luck of the draw. But I think for smaller companies, it would be beneficial to start earlier. And maybe from a financial perspective, that's the limitation, right? That, well, that means I have to, you know, put forth some cost, you know, each year, right? Without necessarily having a visa. So,
And, you know, also I hear the horror stories, right? And I think one of the things that you're not saying, Kareen, because you're probably a little humble and don't want to say it, that the companies that engage and look, we'll use Fraggleman as the top immigration law firm in the country. I'm not saying that just as a commercial. It's just, it's a fact. It's globally recognized, and it is one of the top immigration law firms. And I think small, medium-sized companies, you know, may not be aware that bringing in a top-notch law firm is certain. It is a lottery. I get that. But understanding the deadlines and the forms and everything else from a top-notch law firm certainly would seem to increase your chances of being, you know, having a good shot at the lottery. And I think small, medium-sized companies oftentimes may, you know, look, it's just a couple of forms. We'll do it ourselves. And I think you're right. I don't think they're clued into some of the deadlines. Our last podcast, you said, forget about what, you know, you may see, read about deadlines, you know, file early, file earlier than you think is early. And so, I think that a lot of small, mid-sized companies may not be clued into that.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of advanced planning that's needed, a lot of understanding of it's not just a transaction, right? There's a lot more that goes into it, a lot of compliance issues to consider. So I agree with you, you know, whether they reach out to us or another firm, certainly advanced planning is key, and presume you don't have enough time to get it done, and especially with your student graduates.
Yeah. And going back to the number of H-1B visas, I was a part of those lobbying efforts in the 2000s when I worked for the American Electronic Association, and walking into some of those congressional offices, it didn't seem to be like it was a hard sell, right? We just, you know, brought up the impact on the economy and, you know, what they bring. And it certainly would seem to be a good deal for the United States to increase that number, but it's a political question, and we'll do what we can do. But that 57% increase in applications is really, really staggering. What do you think is driving that? Is it just strictly the talent wars? Is it that overseas talent is improving? What do you think is driving that increase?
You know, I think in part it's perhaps more accessible, the lottery registration process, right, that was implemented a couple years ago, has made the process perhaps more accessible on one hand to the individual, right? Because, you know, at first glance, right, to the unsophisticated eye, well, I'm just going to register. I've got an employer. I found an employer who's willing to sponsor me. We're just going to register. We're going to pay the $10 and be done, right? That seems pretty easy and simple. Why not? I'm going to just spend $10. And so what happens next, though, is the numbers that will be important to watch for over the next couple of months is how much of those 484,000 actually, amounted to filings, right? And so that's kind of why in the last couple of years, we saw a second round of lottery open up in the fall, yet a third one last year in December, because not all of these registrations actually turn out to be viable filings, right? But I think that I do think the talent wars have something to do with it. I do think that, we probably have seen an increase, in post-pandemic in foreign student admission at universities. And so that's creating our pipeline to H-1Bs as well. So I think there's a few factors here.
So you have noticed, and I think the White House is a little bit under the radar, and I can understand why with the current kind of environment and how people think about immigration. Again, these is automatically turned to legal immigration, but it seems like the current administration, as we're talking about innovation, and while I don't want to say have been sneaking in some neat immigration things, but we certainly have seen, the positive. I think you mentioned, and maybe you can elaborate on that, about the STEM adding another 2 years to the STEM graduates. Are there other things that you see the administration doing that, at least for our audience, high tech companies, the innovation economy, might make it a little bit easier on talent?
Yeah, for sure. So certainly the administration and current and past, right, have recognized that the STEM industry is an important one for our economy and for the U.S. to stay competitive, particularly, as we in comparison to China, for example, right? And so one of the initiatives that recently that was put forth this January is expanding the STEM programs, meaning there was up till now a certain number of degree fields that were considered to be STEM field for purposes of that additional 2 years of optional practical training. They've expanded that to include 22 new degree fields, which is really interesting because if you look at some of the positions that are kind of more on the shortage side, a lot of the data science positions, right, come up. And so it's very encouraging to see that part of those two new degree fields include data sciences, data analytics, and then some more businessy type positions, such as business data analytics, financial analytics, economics. That's a pretty big expansion in my view, and that could certainly provide employers with a bit more flexibility there and broader talent pool. With respect to folks with PhDs in STEM fields, there's been a bit more guidance from USCIS on what it would take to qualify for other visa types, such as the O-1. That's the Extraordinary Ability Visa. We leverage this quite a bit for our employers when folks did not get selected in the H-1B. It's also a good first pathway to permanent residency. Those are all encouraging, right? Certainly encouraging as far as recognizing the need to keep those that are graduating from our universities in the U.S. in those STEM fields. I think some like 42% of STEM PhD graduates from the U.S. are international students. I mean, that's a pretty large number. And if they can't stay here, they'll be going taking that knowledge somewhere else, right?
And we see that at several area universities. Universities love foreign students. We know why.
For sure.
And they pay full freight on time and everything else, which is nice for the universities, which is a nice revenue stream. I'm not hitting the universities for that. It's just reality. And so there's they certainly go out of their way to recruit foreign students. And it's just a shame that we end up losing them. So right now they have. And the reason I'm delving a little bit, we have a university talent initiative where we want to encourage the students to stay here. And one of the barriers we run into sometimes is we found a great student we want to bring in, but he's from China. And how long are we going to have? And, you know, part of what we've been saying is, look, grab them for as long as you can. I mean, if it's 3 years, it's 3 years, but it's going to develop linkages and everything else. Do you think in the future, so are there opportunities for students who want to stay with an advanced degree in the United States, is it more likely they're going to be able to stay here in the future or less or about the same? I mean, whether it's a green card or one of the other immigration paths, how likely is it that they can stay if they want to?
Yeah. So, I mean, again, planning ahead is key, right? Let's leverage all the time that we have so that we can get as many bites at the apple on the H-1B as possible. And then certainly exploring other visa options. So the O-1, I love that visa because it does allow you to be creative. It allows you to push the envelope. It really is a great opportunity for those in STEM field, especially with PhDs. And then there's the green card route currently. And there's kind of a parallel visa or green card path to the O-1, extraordinary ability. There's also the national interest waiver pathway to permanent residency. The challenge that we're facing right now with the green card process, and China less perhaps, certainly, you know, they're subject to quotas, less impacted perhaps than folks from India, let's say. But it's the green card quota limits, right? And so that has caused some challenges, especially for folks who aren't selected on the H-1B. It's like, how do I get to the green card stage where I can get a work permit if I'm running out of employment authorization? Because I wasn't selected on the H-1B. Now there's America Compete Act that was passed earlier this year is encouraging. It would provide a direct path to the green card for those who earn a PhD in STEM fields, meaning that they would be exempt from the green card quota. So, hoping to pass, and this would boost the U.S. competitiveness with China, and provide a new pathway to the green card process for those who earn a PhD in STEM fields.
In my perfect world, we have PhD recruiters in the embassies all across the world recruiting PhDs to come to the United States. And if you look at some of our biggest people, you know, some of our biggest innovators, you know, folks like Elon Musk and think if they would have had to gone to another country rather than the United States. And it really is just mind-boggling at the lack of awareness of our government about the positive effects that come with immigration. So looking out a little bit, so you've given us a good view, may not have been a positive view, but it was a realistic view on what's going on with H-1B visas, a little bit of the spousal documentation. If you look out a little bit in the horizon, what do you see good or bad coming up on the horizon that we should keep an eye on?
Yeah, so one of the things definitely to be mindful of, right, again, with is kind of a compliance, worksite enforcement and compliance. So Biden is certainly pro-labor, and so those enforcement protections will remain in place. We've started seeing worksite enforcement or site visits come up again. We had some interesting ones come up during the pandemic where DHS agents were asking employees to meet at the local Starbucks. I mean, there's been some interesting situations. But as employers remobilize, it's a good time to revisit those protocols, right? What happens if an agent arrives on site? And who do we contact in this hybrid work environment? I-9 compliance is a big one as well. while we've certainly seen concessions from the government with respect to how to inspect documents virtually, these were concessions, temporary concessions. And so employers should really take a look and see how were they conducting I-9s during the pandemic? Were they using a third-party agent or were they conducting those virtually? Because there may be some obligations triggered as they bring back their workforce on site. We are still going to see, I don't know if folks remember, but under Trump, there had been increased wage requirements proposed. Department of Labor had attempted to pass a new rule that was supposed to take effect March 15, 2021. This was kind of stalled in the courts due to some legal challenges, but it is the Department of Labor is expected to pass and to promulgate a new revised rule and implement this. So we should expect increased wage requirements for processes requiring a prevailing wage from Department of Labor, and that would affect the H-1Bs and the labor certification green card process. So to your earlier point, you know, smaller companies, smaller employers, how will they be impacted perhaps by, will they be kind of shut out of the H-1B process? The wage requirement is certainly a factor to consider, right? There will be some increased wages that will be required in order to obtain an H-1B.
Well, and it'll be interesting to see how they get that prevailing wage information, because that could even be regional, right? You're going to make a lot more in Silicon Valley or San Diego than you might in Utah or someplace else. No offense against people who live in Utah. So Karine, the last time you gave us our parting words were early. What and I'm going to put you on the spot. We didn't talk about this. So if there was kind of a thing or a sentence or something that you would advise in the current climate, what would that be?
So early is still definitely sound advice, but it's also recognizing that it's becoming more complex, right? And we certainly saw this during the pandemic, but even post-pandemic, there are just various layers of analyses that are required for each process. And I know we talked about more about the spouses, but that's a perfect example of, you know, the challenges. It's not just I'm going to file a work permit and I'm going to get the automated extension. It requires a lot of maneuvering, a lot of collaboration and coordination with the employer, the employee, the dependent spouse, and obviously the service provider. And so that requires a lot of time in advance and preparation. And it does require that partnership with your service provider so that each process is really approached with a holistic approach, right? And I think when we inherit cases, oftentimes it's because there wasn't that approach, and people don't know the questions they don't know, right? And so this is no longer a just fill out a form and submit a form.
Well, I think that's sound advice. My advice is get a service provider to help you out. Ask them what kind of experience they have. Labor law expertise is not immigration expertise. They may intersect, but certainly when you check with your service provider, ask them specifically if they have specific resources dedicated to immigration law. Fragelman, of course, does. I know that we'll have. I didn't read off your bio, Karine, because it's too long. It's 3 pages and very lengthy and a lot of great stuff. But when I introduced you as one of the global experts on immigration law, your biography certainly warrants that, and your work warrants that. We'll put your contact information, those of the firm, in the liner notes for this podcast, and we will release you to go back to work and get everything done. We will see you on the next podcast. This is Kevin Carroll. Carroll, Executive Director, Tech San Diego, signing off. Corrine, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks again. Thanks so much for having me.
Since 1994, Tech San Diego has provided a unifying voice for San Diego's technology community, fostering growth and business acceleration through collaborations between industry, education, and government. We support members from all sectors of the technology industry, including cybersecurity, big data, robotics, SaaS, biotech and healthcare, Internet of Things, defense, telecom, and more. Learn more about us at www.techsandiego.org. Tech San Diego Spotlight is hosted by Tech San Diego's Executive Director, Kevin Carroll. We want to thank Corrine Wenger of Fragoman for joining us again today. Fragoman is a firm of more than 4,300 immigration-focused professionals and staff spanning more than 55 offices worldwide. Immigration has been their sole focus for 70 years, and today they offer support in more than 170 countries. As immigration around the world becomes more and more complex, they rely on many of their professionals' years of experience working in government agencies and in-house corporate immigration departments to advance world-class compliant immigration solutions. To learn more about Fragoman, visit www.fragomen.com. Producers for Tech San Diego Spotlight are Kevin Carroll and Sarah Spiva. Tech San Diego Spotlight is recorded remotely and edited by Hypable Impact. If you enjoyed this podcast episode, make sure to like, follow, and share.